Live Creative Now, episode 62.
Welcome to Live Creative Now with Melissa Dinwiddie, a weekly podcast to inspire you to create your art and share your work, because that's how you will change the world.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Melissa Dinwiddie, passion pluralite artist, happiness catalyst, and creativity instigator, here to address all your questions about living a full color creative life. My last episode, episode 61, was all about the question, how can I create? How can I do the thing that makes me so happy and so joyful when other people are suffering? If you have ever felt guilty or felt like you couldn't possibly do your creative thing after a tragedy or when people in your life are miserable for whatever reason, so, you know, how can you be happy because they're miserable? You need to listen to episode 61. So check that out. Today, you get to be a fly on the wall for a conversation I had with one of my artist peer heroes, Chris Wesley. This is a pretty long conversation. It's over an hour. And we actually spoke last year, way back in September of 2015. And the reason it's taken me so long to publish it is that I originally planned, when I started my podcast, I originally planned to publish conversations, oh, maybe once a month. But I realized pretty quickly that if I'm going to do any editing and put together any kind of comprehensive show notes, it is just way faster and easier to do a monologue. And that kind of surprised me because I honestly thought that episodes with guests would be faster because, after all, I don't have to come up with the content. The guest provides the content. Our conversation just becomes the content. And with my monologues, I put a lot of time into writing out what I want to talk about before I do the recording. But once the recording is done, conversations with guests are a lot more work because in order to create show notes, I have to listen to the entire conversation again and take notes. And my perfectionist tendencies kind of go wild. Yes, I am a self-labeled card-carrying imperfectionist, but what that really means is a recovering perfectionist because I really have problems with perfectionism, and I have visions of editing my conversation recordings into these really tight, streamlined, narrated, really cool This American Life kinds of productions. And that is just crazy time consuming, like full-time job time consuming. And I don't have that kind of time. I have a job. So I have a lot of interviews, a lot of recorded conversations that have just been sitting on my hard drive for months. And I finally realized that the only way to get these recordings out onto the podcast so that you could hear them would be to lower my expectations. Either that or hire an editor to do all the work for me. And I just don't have the funds for that. So I sent my perfectionist gremlins off to get a pedicure, and I decided to publish this conversation with Chris unedited. Boom. You are truly getting to be a fly on the wall. And if there are sections that are not interesting for you, that sort of lag for you or whatever, that is what the fast forward button is for. And if you don't have time to listen to over an hour right now, hey, that is the beauty of podcasts. You can turn them off and pick right back up where you left off later. So, without further ado, I want to introduce my friend, Chris Wesley. Chris is a real Renaissance guy. I met him at a music conference several years ago. We were both there to learn how to market our music more effectively, and everybody got a chance to play songs. And instead of playing his songs, which he has plenty of, he read poetry. And that really perked up my ears. That was different. And it turns out that in addition to being a musician and a poet, he's also a killer fiction writer. He's got multiple books under his belt, and he's a really good fiction too. And he's a photographer, incredible photographer, and a fine artist. And in fact, I think there might be nothing that he doesn't do, this man. We have had a few conversations over the years about being an artist and combining art with the rest of life, like, you know, making a living, having a relationship, all of that. So when I was planning on starting my podcast, which, by the way, will be exactly 1 year ago next week, it will be the 1 year anniversary of Live Creative Now next week, but I digress. Over a year ago, when I was planning on starting my podcast, I knew that Chris was someone I wanted to share with you. So let's do this. I hope you enjoy being a fly on the wall for my conversation with Chris Wesley, author, fine artist, and explorer of the human condition. Let's list out, because I know you do a lot. You do the sound production.
Yes.
And you are a writer.
Yep.
You're a novelist and a poet.
Yes.
You are a photographer.
Yes.
And you're a musician.
Yep.
And what else is there? I know I'm missing something.
Well, sound engineer and producing are actually two completely different skill sets. I also mix music, play guitar, bass, keyboards, and I took singing lessons, but I don't keep up. As a singer, I'm sure you understand, you have to work those muscles. So I don't actually keep that up, but I understand the mechanics of singing. So if I'm producing a session, if the singer's not doing something right, their tongue's not in the right place, or they're doing something with enunciation that's not right, I can actually coach them to do what they, you know, get them where their voice needs to be. So I think that's about it. Every now and then I'm painting a little bit now. Just pretty much whatever. Oh, no, I take that back. I've also done screenwriting. I've acted in short films and in plays, and done camera work like cinematography, Steadicam, video editing, motion graphics. We'll call it there. I think that's enough.
Basically, you are the quintessential Renaissance man.
Yeah, and to be perfectly honest, it wasn't by choice. It was by need.
Okay, tell me more about that.
Originally, I picked up the guitar. That was going to be what I wanted to do. When I first picked up the guitar, you know, that was pretty much my only hope. I had a difficult childhood. And when I was 14, I really had nothing to look forward to except, you know, maybe eventually getting put in jail or getting killed. I kind of focused on guitar. When I picked up the guitar, I pretty much, prior to the guitar, I was always in the streets. And my parents thought they knew where I was, but they never actually knew where I was and what I was doing. And when I picked up the guitar, that was my hope. I quit everything. I started practicing 5 hours a day. When they enrolled me in lessons, I was picking up the stuff so quick because I was putting so much into it that my teacher and I would get into arguments because he would say, okay, well, you know, play the pentatonic scale or harmonic minor scale. And I'm like, we already went over that. Why are we going over this crap again? And he'd say, it's because you're going through it so fast. I want to make sure you're actually getting it. And so guitar was my focus. That was everything. The guitar and songwriting and writing lyrics, which is part of songwriting. So those were my things. And I put together bands when I couldn't find a band to join, as there was a whole racial thing. This is the 80s, you know, prior to Living Color. And I mean, there was Sound Barrier that was like local, but aside from that, people didn't play heavy metal music or thrash metal music if they were black.
And that was your preferred genre?
Yeah, I played, you know, in the vein of like early 80s, early mid 80s, like Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, that kind of stuff. And so I couldn't find bands that would let me join, so I started my own. And usually the people I picked up in most cases were kind of beginners, because those are the more open-minded people. And so I had to learn their instruments to teach them how to play the songs I was writing. When things never worked out with that, so eventually I went solo. Well, when I went solo, now I didn't have anyone to play anything. I obviously couldn't play all the instruments myself, so I learned how to record so I could at least get the songs down. And, you know, as time progressed, I would pick up more skills because it was the only way to get things done and get things out.
Wow. That's a great story. How old were you? Like, with this period of guitar being everything, this guitar and being a singer-songwriter, what age did that take you to?
21, when I gave up on everybody else and decided that I had to take control of everything and just do it myself if it was going to get done.
And had you, what was your path up to that point? Like, you're in high school, what age were you when you started playing guitar?
14.
You were 14.
So
you dove into it 5 hours a day, really intense, keeps you off the street, presumably keeps you away from a short, violent life. And so what was this alternate path, where did that take you? Walk me through that.
Well, that was actually the first time, ironically enough, it meant so much to me that it was the first time I felt like I had something to lose. Because to be honest, up prior to the guitar, even if I were to lose my life, it didn't feel like it would actually be losing anything. So when I picked up the guitar, I actually picked up my grades just out of fear that if the grades slipped, then my parents might take that away. So for me, it was something I enjoyed, it was something I was passionate about, it was, for me, my mindset was, this is work. This is necessary for me. This isn't, let's, you know, hang out and just have a good time. It was, for me, this was pretty much life or death. So I, throughout high school, would try different things. Nothing ever worked. A lot of the stuff I wrote, the bands I mentioned, they were pretty technical. Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, well, more Megadeth, Metallica, are a little bit more technical in how good you have to be on your instrument to play that stuff. But I also listened to progressive metal. So the stuff I was writing was pretty hardcore, time changes, difficult passages to play. And over the course of time, I eventually, you know, my mom didn't want me to be in a band because she felt if I played that kind of music, I was going to worship the devil and I was going to take drugs and everything else. She didn't understand that that was what was actually I wouldn't have done drugs anyhow, but that was actually a positive thing for me. So I actually moved out of her house to start a band and moved out with other band members. Things kind of over time went to hell with that. And so over the course of like age 20 to 21, that's when things really just kind of got bad. And I decided I had to just go solo.
So how old were you when you moved out from your mom's house?
19 or 20.
Okay. And then you went solo, and then you started to learn all these other things that you needed in order to do what you wanted to do. Did you go to college, or what led you to this, your day job that you've got now? What was that path?
Well, I worked in a coffee shop. That was my first job, and actually I only got that job so I could buy a better amp. The goal was to work long enough to afford a better, bigger amp, and then I was going to quit. but that didn't quite work out that way. I ended up having to keep the job so I could get a car. And from the coffee shop, I worked for Toys R Us for about 2 weeks before I got my current job at the hospital I work at now, and started there as just a file clerk. And, you know, I've been there since 1987. So I'd done just about every job in that department aside from be a manager. And pretty much that part of my life has stayed pretty consistent. I mean, the day job was never an ambition for me. I never really considered the day job as a career path. It was the creative stuff I was doing that I considered more my career, and that's where I invested my time. And, you know, I did at one point go to college and got a degree in multimedia technology, but I didn't go to college until I was 29 and pursue that degree. And that actually was... it was one of those crossroads, because I had grown just so tired of fighting that I had become suicidal, because I just felt like there was just, I could not affect my life. And I felt like if I can't actually change anything, if things are just going to be crap from then on out, I couldn't see me becoming the person I wanted to be. I saw a future where I was going to become like the people, well, just being an ass and a hateful destroyer of a person. And I would rather die than be that. So I had come about that close to suicide. I talked myself down by deciding that if I was going to continue to fight, I had to do it a different way. And that's when I ended up going back to school.
Wow. I'm curious about that. Can you tell more about this? Like, what was the fighting? What was, I want to unpack that a little bit.
Well, for me, life had always been kind of a battle, because I had in my mind the kind of person that I wanted to be, but to, you know, to honestly, to be a gentle person, to be a kind, happy person, someone that spreads like happiness with the people they're around, you can't struggle through everything. You can't feel like every last thing you're doing, you're failing in. And in music, which was something that meant so much to me, that's all I was doing. I was failing in every last thing that I attempted. I'd try solo, that wasn't working so well. I could never really keep bands together. When I was releasing music, I was reaching an audience, but when it came to peers and with only a couple exceptions in the press, I was not taken seriously, and I didn't see any way to get around that. There was nothing I could see I could do differently with it. So with school, the idea originally was to get Microsoft certification and just go into the technical field. But I couldn't get student loans for just certification. I had to go into a degree program. I could not see going for a degree program that didn't involve creativity. So I opted for the multimedia technology, which, you know, it's a technical school. So they were kind of feeling out their curriculum at the time. And so even though it's a Bachelor of Science degree, there's along with building computers and understanding the technical aspects, where there was a real heavy design element to it. You know, we went through Photoshop and Illustrator and Flash, and we even did traditional animation, like hand-drawn with the animation paper, and created animations and scanned it and turned those into, like, you know, short films and stuff like that. So I went from everything from building websites to motion graphics, the kind of stuff you see like for movie intros and all that. So I now use all those things that I picked up in that program.
Wow. I'm thinking about, so one of the things we didn't touch on when we were going through all the various different kind of creative outlets that you have what is the multimedia piece, because you use a lot of multimedia in your stories. Can you talk a little bit about that?
In what way? What would you like to know about it?
Tell me how you got started. Tell me what a little bit, so for people who haven't experienced your work, a little bit about what the multimedia aspect is.
Okay.
And how you got into that.
Okay, let me answer how I got into it first. I actually, through poetry, at one point I just stripped down the whole music thing and just said, I'm just going to focus on lyrics and poetry and that kind of stuff. And I had joined a group of poets called Poets on Site. And Kathabella Wilson, she's basically the leader of the group. The group spans multiple cities, states, I want to say potentially countries as a whole. And the group will go into galleries and write poems based on the works of art in the galleries, and would do performances, would set up performances where we kind of tour through the gallery with guests and the different poets. We would read our poems next to the art pieces that inspired it. So when I moved into the fiction writing, you know, I don't want to give up the other things that I do. Now, music is where I started. That is a really important thing for me. I've always been interested in photography and design and just all these different things. So, you know, I begin with the fiction, book, and I use the photography to help. I use that as prompts for certain characters and helps me develop characters actually in some new tangents that I otherwise wouldn't have kind of set them on. And mix that with the poetry a little bit for the extra stuff. And, well, one of the things is, I don't know, did you use the story marks at all? The bookmarks that have links to additional story?
I haven't clicked through any of the links.
Okay. So the idea behind that is to mix all of that together and to reward the readers that go the extra mile. So if someone just reads the book, then they have an idea of what takes place in the story. And so if they read Gospel of Wolves, they have a certain point of view. But if, let's say, if they read the story mark that came with the book, which has my fine art photography on the front of it, and then some poetry on the back, then it introduces the reader to the Gospel of Wolves world, but through the eyes of Aristotle Troublefield's girlfriend. So if you take that extra step, what you read there will actually alter your view of what you just read. Or if you haven't read the book yet, you'll read the book with basically insider information. You kind of know some of the stuff that's going on behind the scenes that's affecting the main characters in the book that's never actually explained. And let's see, you finished the book?
Oh yeah, I loved it.
Okay, so you know at one point in the book someone gets shot and you think you know why that person got shot. If you read the additional information in the second story mark, you have a better understanding of why that person got shot, why that was going to happen regardless of anything anybody did. And it sets you up, you have an understanding of some of the conflicts that are going to come in the next book.
Wow, it's so creative what you've done, Chris. And I love how you have brought together, like you were saying, so many of the various different elements that, like, you've written songs that are specifically like part of that world that you created with your novel.
Yes. Actually, for the second story mark, when you click through, it's takes you through six short fictions that looks at the world from the point of view of the character Aristotle Troublefield's producer, Gloon. And through that world, it actually introduces you to the music of four of the characters. As you go through the short fictions, embedded in the short fictions are players where you can listen to some of the songs where the songs are written in character.
I love it. So cool. So all of this brings to mind a very important question. How do you make time for all of this?
I don't sleep a lot. You know, I don't consider myself a true insomniac, but I'm kind of close. I have a very, very difficult time getting to sleep. I always have so much going through my mind that it's very hard for me to turn it off and actually get to a restful state to sleep. Usually I actually have to read to do it. And hopefully the book is good enough to keep my attention, but not good enough to keep me awake.
Exactly.
Yeah. And to a large degree, I focus on one thing at a time. One of the things I learned when I was recording my music, you know, recording albums by myself, is I had to take on different roles. So there was a point in time where I was predominantly a songwriter. And once the songs were done, then I had to think as a producer. I had to think in larger terms as far as song order and what instrumentation was needed. And sometimes that would offend the songwriter in me. And I just had to accept that when I take on these roles, that role sometimes is going to make decisions that the other roles aren't going to particularly like. And then for a producer, I'd think as, you know, when I was actually recording, I had to think as an engineer. After the song was over, I had to think like a song mixer. And I kind of skipped over when I was recording or programming the drums, I'd think like a drummer. When I had to record the guitars, I had to think like a guitarist. The bass parts, I always recorded all of the bass parts at the same time, because I had to, you know, really practice enough to be able to play the songs. I don't do a lot of edits. Basically, if I don't screw up in the first two bars, I just go through and whatever comes, comes. So I do that actually with the fiction and with the fine art photography and all that. When I'm writing the novel itself, I'm a novelist. I do not consider the other parts of it beyond what do I know about the characters. And, you know, to a certain point, the characters kind of dictate what they're going to do, how they're going to behave. And then when the novel's done, then I'll think about the story marks. You know, which characters would provide an interesting angle that has to change the reader's perception of what is in the book. That's one of the criteria for me with that. It can't just be fluff. There has to be real story there that gives you more information about what's going on. And for me, it has to change your perception of what you thought you read. And so for those, I think in terms of that, and, you know, as a publisher, I have to kind of think in terms of, well, what's reasonable to put out? Because the artist in me wants to just do everything. And who cares about money? Who cares about how am I going to afford to do any of this stuff? I just want to do it. So the publisher in me has to think, well, what can I afford to do?
Amen to that.
Yeah, because the artist says, well, isn't that what credit is for? So someone has to be the daddy and say no.
And you've managed to be able to play all those different roles. That, I mean, I love that you shared that. I think that's a really useful piece that will be really helpful for a lot of people. And you're a great example of something that I figured out in my 30s. Took me that long to figure it out. How does it go? You do get to do everything. just not all at the same time.
Yes, exactly. You have to pick and choose the battles.
Yeah. So you clearly have a business going with your music, sound engineering, and music production.
Yes.
And you also sell your novels on Kindle, and you do exhibits of your photography, your fine art photography, and presumably sell those as well.
Just before we got on.
Oh, literally. Excellent. Congratulations. That's very cool. Have you ever been tempted to leave the full-time job in order to make your creative things your revenue, you know, your sole revenue stream or your main revenue stream?
That's the goal, but I do believe, you know, I grew up with, there was no safety net. At one point when I was in school, where I work was laying off entire departments and all that. I mean, there was actually a point where I was near homeless. And so for me, yes, I would love to quit the day job and just go full time with the art, but there has to be, in my mind, a reasonable, feasible plan on how that's going to happen. And with what I'm seeing these days, you know, or actually, I take that back. With what I'm doing, I'm spending a lot of time trying to educate people on how all these pieces fit together because no one is doing that. I think there's something to the model, but I haven't figured the model out. So I think right now it would be foolish to quit a job that's actually paying bills go out there and just try and figure it out. You know, I'm married, so I have to consider my family aside from myself and what kind of strain would that put on my relationship. So there's, you know, prior to getting married, there was just, how am I going to pay rent and eat? You know, we hear these stories about these successful people that, yeah, I lived in my car for a year and all that. And, you know, that's great that they succeeded, but they didn't succeed in my mind because they lived in their car. There were other factors that played a part. And there are a lot of people who lived in their car and, you know, depending on where they lived, froze to death or starved to death or anything, that you'll never hear those stories because those aren't the success stories that will pull in the ratings for whatever program you're watching.
Yeah, so true. The other thing is, I know you and I have had conversations before about how having a separate income source that's separate from your creative expression, there's a real beauty to that. It allows this freedom that you don't necessarily have or perceive if your creative expression is your main income source.
Yes. If my creativity was my main income source, I would not be doing what I'm doing now. Because if you just take a moment to think about it, what media company would encompass, you know, who am I going to sign with that's going to allow me to do the things I'm doing? No publisher that I'm aware of is putting out books and selling records and producing, you know, little design elements that are getting mailed out to the buyers and putting on art shows in galleries and selling fine artwork through websites. I don't know of any company that is progressive enough to take me on and let me do all these different things and piece them all together into one large story world. What I think would happen is there would be one company handling this, another company handling that, and you know, well, you can't do this because we're not getting paid for you to do this. You know, there'd just be a lot of infighting.
Well, because of the internet, there is so much more possibility for people nowadays to bring in money in ways that weren't possible before, like Patreon, the site that allows people to have, donate on an ongoing basis to a creator of some sort. I will eventually get my Patreon page up for the podcast. but it's still, you know, it's still not an easy thing.
No.
To create a profitable business from your creativity. And there is a way in which it's just so easy to start creating to the audience, to, you know, the critics' demands, rather than for your own fulfillment, you know, to feed your own soul.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the beautiful things about having a different income source, that a lot of, you know, it's like the Holy Grail. Like everybody wants, everybody who's a creator, almost to a person, has a desire on some level to, you know, earn, to be able to do their creative thing full time, right? And to be able to just do that and have that generate the income so they don't have to go off and spend their time, so they can have more time to do their creative thing, right? But the reality is, it's not really that you're going to have more time to do your creative thing. It's that you're going to be, instead of spending 8 hours a day working at your 9-to-5 job, you're going to be spending 6 or 8 hours a day on the business and marketing.
Yeah. Back to the admin stuff and pushing paper and coding and, you know, figuring out, okay, well, what's going to maximize every web page to get people to do what I want to do. And, you know, it's, I don't know, I'm going to define artists as people who create to express. And when you create to express, it is a very difficult thing to have to conform to try and make money.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the things that a lot of people don't understand about people who are artists, who their primary goal is to express something, to touch people, and to reach their tribe, to reach the people that feel the way they feel and, you know, connect, versus the people who just want to be famous, who just want everyone to recognize them on magazine covers and cash checks. And, you know, one of the programs my wife and I watch is Nashville. I don't know. Have you watched that at all?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So there's a girl on there at one point. She's a country artist, and artist as in trying to express herself. And, you know, they stick her with some producer, they're moving her towards pop and changing her image, and, you know, they're dressing her and doing all these things, and she's miserable. And my wife's all, well, you know, she has a hit single and all these things are going for her. Everything is looking successful. What's her problem? Why is she depressed? I'm thinking, because she's an artist and she wants to express what she's feeling, not what some accountant is feeling or some other guy that's just looking at the charts saying, yes, this style of music.
Exactly. Exactly. I think about, you were talking about doing animation in school, and that's my latest thing. Just in the past week, I started playing around for the first, I've always wanted to play around with animation by hand, stop motion and drawn animation. And now, because, you know, there's an app for everything. So now there's an app for that. And so I started playing around with it. And, you know, this is not something that I have any fantasies is going to, you know, make me a living. I'm doing it because it's fun. And for me, I love your definition of create to express. I'm totally stealing that. Crediting you, of course.
Thank you.
Art is somebody who creates to express. And also for me, I create to discover.
Yes.
To explore. And that's why I got so burned out on my art business, because I was creating to please other people rather than to please myself. And that can be a very satisfying thing to do, you know, working as a graphic designer, or, you know, I was doing commissioned artwork, and a lot of most cases, it was usually commissioned fine artwork, usually involving calligraphy, and taking the client's ideas and desires and combining that with my vision and coming out with a final product. And there is that can be very satisfying, but it's a different animal. It's a totally different animal. And I am always preaching the importance of doing that thing that's going to feed you, because the purpose is joy, not only doing the thing that is feeding your client, you know, giving them what they need, because that's a sure route to burnout.
Exactly. And that's actually, you probably didn't know this, but that's your message with that is actually a large part of why you wound up on the special thanks in my first book.
I have to tell you, when I read that, so at the very end of Chris's first book, there's this wonderfully written, like, pages what do they call it? Thank yous, appreciations, and they're delightful to read. And I always love reading those sections of books. So I'm happily reading along and I'm thinking, oh, I met that person. I remember, I know who that person is. And all of a sudden I see my own name. It was an amazing moment.
No, but I mean, the things you preach about, you know, being true to yourself and not listening to, I'm using your term, listening to your gremlins. And there, it's a very, very important message. And it spoke to me. And that's why the first book came out the way it did, because it was, in all honesty, it wasn't supposed to be a story. It was supposed to be a poem.
The Gospel of Wolves?
That was supposed to be a book, but Regret and Triptych was supposed to just be a poem.
Oh my gosh.
That's all it was. And some people have commented how the husband is there's the main character that's speaking in the first person, and he doesn't get along with his ex-girlfriend's husband. So throughout the entire book, story, he never ever uses the husband's name. He always uses descriptives.
Right. And they change. I love that.
So that actually was a kind of a happy accident, because originally in the poem, it wasn't supposed to mention anybody's names. And eventually it kept growing despite my best intentions. And as it got longer and longer, I realized, well, I got to use some, you know, I have to at least give her a name. Then it kind of sparked something, because I'd been working on the characters and the storylines for Gospel of Wolves for about 5 years. I've been building this story world. I have amassed a collection of pre-recorded royalty-free music, so I can use that as jump-off points for certain producers' styles, certain artists' styles. I've collected magazines and books as reference items for specific characters and done all this stuff over the course of all these years. And at some point, I thought, you know, maybe these characters can, maybe I can apply some of this work I've put to these characters to that story. And that's how it actually became the story. But I didn't want to name anyone I didn't have to name, because I, you know, the original idea of not naming anybody. So that's how I ended up using descriptives in context for the husband throughout the story.
That's really cool. I love hearing all the work that you put into building that world before you wrote your novel, Gospel of Wolves. It's kind of, how do I put this? I get it now, how I'm being so inarticulate. When I was reading that novel, it struck me how layered that world was. And So now I can have an appreciation for how it got that way. I kind of thought, you know, my God, this guy's just a genius. And maybe you are a genius, but you're a genius who's done the work.
Yeah. Even though there are four main characters in the book, Gospel of Wolves, I know what's going on in the background. There's a lot of stuff that's happening in the background that's affecting the characters. And I reveal some of that and the flash fictions that the story cards introduce you to. But yeah, there are no minor characters. These, even the people who you kind of just seem on the periphery, I know their motivations, why they're behaving the way they are. And in some cases, they're kind of Easter eggs. Some characters that you think are one way, it's going to make a lot more sense in future books where I start answering some of the questions you didn't know you had.
Well, I have to say, I can't wait for the next one to come out, because you do leave it with a bit of a cliffhanger at the end. I was like, what? What? Now I have to wait?
Yeah, it actually, because I have so much, actually, I have whole chapters already written for some of these characters and whole arcs. It took me a long time to figure out where to begin. You know, where do I start the story and kind of drop people into this world? And I don't know if you noticed a lot of the backstory that kind of gets introduced. It's intermingled between what's happening now. It took a long time. I don't know if you know that there were some artists that, Melissa and I shared a mentor in Tim Sweeney. And I don't know, did you know that he actually threatened some artists that if they didn't produce something, if they didn't actually release something, he was going to stop working with them?
Wow. That's some accountability.
Yeah. And I, you know, when I would hear this from people, I was thinking, crap, I kept waiting for the phone call for him to tell me either you produce something or you're done. But, you know, I was thinking, I'm still putting it together. You know, I mean, creating a story world, it's not just figuring out two characters. There's all these things you got to figure out. And I had to, you know, go back and research this. The story starts in 2006. So I had to research, you know, what was actually going on in 2006. These are entertainers. You know, where was technology? Where was the industry? There's stuff with an advertising and branding agency. What was happening in that industry at the time? So there was, even when I kind of narrowed that down, there was a lot of work that went into making it believable.
And presumably you never got that call from Tim.
No, thankfully.
Well, I remember one of, Chris and I met each other at this Music Strategies conference. I went to, I think, three of them all together. And one of these conferences, I remember, I think it was in LA, and a bunch of people were sitting around a table having lunch and talking about raising funds to produce CDs. And this was before Kickstarter, or at least before I knew about Kickstarter. I don't think Kickstarter even existed. And some people were talking about, were sharing that they had raised money by soliciting their fans and saying, hey, can you donate money? You know, this was this really cool new crowdfunding concept, right? And there were some people at the table who had been working on CDs for years. And I determined that I was going to make a CD like that year. And I was going to just get it done. And I was going to raise $2,000. And, you know, I wasn't going to do a $30,000 production. I was going to just, you know, crank out. My goal was to make a CD that was better than the last one I made. And the last one I made was just I had gotten to a chance to sing live on Stanford University radio, and they recorded it. And, you know, it wasn't mixed or mastered or anything. It was just this live recording. So there were lots of mistakes. And I picked the five least cringeworthy tracks and hand burned them onto a CD. Mm-hmm. And, you know, boom, I had CDs to sell at my gigs, which I incidentally was selling them for $5 because there were only five tracks on the CD, right? Right. And I had a phone call with Tim Sweeney, our mentor, and he said, why are you selling your music for $5? You should be selling it for $10. And I said, but but there's only five tracks. And, you know, if they were to download it on iTunes, it would be less than that. Well, don't you believe in your music? You know, didn't you put time into creating it? And didn't you design the label and da 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 blah, blah, blah. And you'll have to sell half as many in order to make the same amount of money. And within 10 minutes, I was all of a sudden selling CDs for $10 instead of $5. And you know what? The number of sales did not go down.
I'm not surprised.
So, yeah.
You know, that's one of the things I've had these talks with different artists about pricing. And, you know, not just artists, even with the studio, when I've rented out my studio to people, you know, I think it was the studio that started it, where I just got, I'm not fighting with you. If you don't want to pay how much it costs, that's fine. We don't have to talk about this anymore. I mean, we could talk about other things, or you can leave, but I'm not going to try and convince you. You know, I was recording this one guy, and at the time I was just trying to build up the reputation of the studio. So, you know, recording, there's, you know, microphones and preamps and compressors and EQ. So I have all these things that are, you know, that are hardware and different mics for different types, for different sounds, different preamps for different sounds, and just all of what goes into understanding how to properly record sound. And this guy looks at me and he says, well, why am I paying you, get this, $20 an hour to use all this stuff when I can just plug my guitar into the USB port in my computer? So I said, if you think that'll get you the same results, I don't know why you're here.
The good response.
You know, and, you know, since then, you know, really when I started focusing on my art rather than trying to help other people create their art in hopes of building a reputation on how to help other people create their art and argue with them why I'm justified in charging however much I'm charging. I changed the way I looked at it, where before it was $20 an hour to rent the studio. Now it's $50 an hour to pry me away from the other things I can be doing with that time.
And that's cheap for a sound engineer.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, people can make that choice. And if they don't want to pay it, that's fine, because I have plenty of things to keep me busy. And the same's gone for the fine art pricing and for the book pricing and all that. I'm not going to argue over it. If someone doesn't want to pay, they don't have to.
I like that attitude too of that. I always say, like, when it comes to pricing, one of the ways that I can know if I'm pricing too little is if I feel any shred of resentment.
Yes.
If I'm feeling resentful, I need to raise my prices, right? Because
yes,
just like you said, that is peeling me away from the other things that I would really like to be spending my time doing.
Yep.
So how much, you must do your producing and your sound engineering on evenings and weekends?
Yes.
And how much of that do you do?
Currently, I'm not doing much of that. Right now, this past Sunday, I had a gallery reception for my fine art photography. And actually, it's one of those pieces that just sold a few minutes ago. Right now, I'm kind of in fine artist mode. And then we're going to have the closing reception September 26th. And following that, I'm going to be in my official novel writing mode again. To get the novels finished, I schedule my time to write. And it doesn't matter whether I feel inspired or whether I even know what it is I'm going to write about. That time is to write. And even if I think what I'm producing is crap, I produce. And on days where I have the time scheduled and there's nothing, I just have nothing to give, then what I do is I switch up the roles a little bit, and then I'll just go back through things I've already written and read it as a reader. What are the things about it that disturb me that I think that's stupid, and so I can delete, and kind of go about it like that. So the work gets put in, you know, I don't get a break because I'm tired. If the time is scheduled, this is like showing up for work.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be fired.
So I have two questions about that. One is, yes. What is your schedule? Like, what are the, do you have time blocks in your calendar set aside? And for how long? Is it for a period of weeks or months, or how does that work for you?
Well, that's the whole idea of deadlines. I normally, well, for Gospel of Wolves, we'll see how this goes with this next book. But for episode one of Gospel of Wolves, I actually missed two deadlines. I set aside 4-hour blocks of time, and it would be between 3 and 4 days a week that was scheduled at 4-hour blocks. And then occasionally I'd sneak in extra time doing stuff with it or for it. This isn't including all the time I spend asking myself, well, why is this person doing this?
Right.
So that goes towards the layering, because even minor characters, I'm asking myself, well, why are they behaving like this? And I'm figuring that out. So I put that time in regardless, and I missed my first deadline. When I missed the first deadline, I immediately set another one that wasn't all that forgiving, which is why I missed the second one. So the third deadline I actually met. But if I miss a deadline, you know, I'm kind of wearing my publisher hat then, whereas I'm not saying, oh, poor you, you just weren't, you know, you didn't have enough time. It's more like, well, what the hell? You know, you missed the deadline. You know, we have to ship. We have to ship. So I produce another deadline that kind of puts me a little bit, you know, puts a little bit of fire under me, and it go from there. Is actually, I don't know if you know this. I had, because of a deadline, oh, you know what? I missed three deadlines. The original deadline I missed was because I lost the book.
What?
I had the book all mapped out, arcs and everything, parts of the book written out on index cards. And because I was behind, I decided that I was going to, and I know it's going to make me sound like an ass, but I own that. I brought it with me on when my wife and I flew to Hawaii to celebrate our anniversary. So the idea was, there are times, you know, during the vacation where she's asleep, or, you know, she is a marathon runner, she'll get up early and she'll go out and run. So I figure I'll take that time and I'll work on the novel. Or, you know, even during the flight, you know, she has her headphones on, she's looking out the window or reading a book, I'm going to work. And that's what I did. I brought out those cards and started working on it. At some point during the flight, we switched seats. Yeah. I not only left the index cards in the seat back that my wife was sitting on when we, or sitting in when we landed, because I, of course, always check that before I get up. It wasn't in there. It was in hers. So we had probably about a half hour, 45-minute layover. I remembered or realized what happened 5 minutes before we had to board the next plane. I had to give it up. Ugh. I had to choose not to be angry, because we weren't there for me to work on the novel anyhow, and focus on my marriage. But I did have to rewrite what I couldn't remember.
Oh, man.
It's not always easy being an artist.
Devastating. Ugh.
It was. But, you know, as artists, we have to, and I'm sure you know this, there's give and take. There's sometimes where you have to sacrifice aspects of being an artist for the sake of your relationship, because otherwise it's not going to last. You're going to be alone.
Eventually. Right. Yeah.
What were you going to say?
Well, it sounds like your wife is very supportive.
She's ridiculously supportive. I'm not, you know, I appreciate that, because when I consider, she's never, ever, ever given me any kind of crap over regret in triptych. Okay. Backstory on that. You've read the book, so you know, the main character, his wife dies. He disappears for 7 months. When he comes back, he's on the doorstep of an ex-girlfriend. And you spend the entire book wondering, are he and the ex-girlfriend going to hook up?
Yes. Okay. I did wonder that.
Yeah. And that tension is there deliberately. So my current wife read the book where the wife dies, and you spend the rest of the time wondering, is he hooking up with the ex-girlfriend? Now, one of my best friends is an ex-girlfriend. So to never hear anything about that, for never getting any attitude or anything, for her to understand that this is just fiction, that there's nothing in, there's no real life in it.
Yeah.
That's a pretty special woman.
Well, I can't imagine you being with somebody else. I mean, people like us,
yeah,
we couldn't be in a relationship with somebody who wouldn't be able to support it, because yeah. It just wouldn't work.
No, that was actually one of my criteria when I was dating. If I had to explain why I was an artist, if I had to show if I had to validate it. And yes. Anyway, we were done.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like that is what made me finally see my husband as a contender, because it took me 2.5 years to see him as a contender. And what really, one of the things, critical things that really did it was realizing, wow, this guy is really, he's really my champion.
Yes.
And when you've experienced that, there's no going back. When you've experienced being with somebody who can really champion you and who does so just wholeheartedly with enthusiasm, there's no going back to those relationships where there's competition, where people are jealous of your creative thing, or they want you to be doing their creative thing and not your creative thing, or whatever. There's no going back.
No. Yeah, and I'm so happy you found somebody too.
Oh my God, me too. God bless those, you know, truly support. And I support him too. You know, he's a screenwriter. That's his, he has a full-time non-screenwriting related job. And mm-hmm. he does his screenwriting on the weekends. And, you know, I could be somebody who would say, but I want to spend time with you on the weekend. Instead, I say, have fun screenwriting. Go. You're not scribbling today? Why aren't you scribbling today? You have to get your scribble time in. I mean, come on, I'm a creativity instigator. That's my job. It'd be pathetic if I didn't encourage my husband.
You would have to hide that fact from all of your followers.
Oh my God. It would be like the most hypocritical thing ever.
But you know, the relationship part of it is, at least for me, it's a large part of me remaining like just physically healthy. When I'm left to my own devices, I don't eat. Or if I do eat, it's the fastest thing, because, you know, I'm working on whatever and I think, okay, I'll just do this one thing and then I'll eat something. And then 2 hours passes. I'm like, oh yeah, I haven't eaten yet, but okay, well, just this one last thing. And either that, or, okay, I'm just going to finish typing this sentence. And then I get the blue screen of death on the computer. And now I have to redo all these things that I was previously doing. And, you know, 6 hours will pass between the idea that I should have eaten something and me actually eating anything.
Yes.
And then it's not like real food. It's like, what's the fastest thing I can prepare?
And cram in your face. Exactly. I so relate to that.
You know, so Pat makes sure I actually eat real food.
God bless her. Well, what I love about your story, Chris, is it's such a great example of the power of creative expression to, you know, transform lives.
I think, well, yeah, without the creativity, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
That's for sure. And that's why, well, I try and put enough of the things I've felt into certain characters. I've actually kind of broken up my history amongst the different characters in the book. Because even though it's not, say, a memoir, the people who feel that way, I believe they can tell. They know when certain emotions come from a real place. And while I'm not going to say what happens to people, because not every story is going to end happily, I do want to give some amount of hope to the people that can relate to, you know, surviving. And when every thought that you have, every decision you make is based on survival. This is what I have to do to stay alive, to get to tomorrow. You know, it's, you don't have to live in a ghetto to experience those feelings.
Yeah.
You can live in suburbs or hell. I've known a couple of people that have lived in mansions that have been that destitute.
Yeah. So I have this is a really tangential, completely yes. off topic question. And I find myself as I read your novel, as I was reading your novel, thinking, you know, curiously about your characters and assuming because you're Black that your characters are Black. And, but you know, you never really, there are characters for whom you never actually specify, except for a word here. They're like there's one place where somebody is labeled as a brunette, I think, which is usually a mm-hmm. white term. At least I've heard it as like, I don't know, you wouldn't call somebody who's Black a brunette, right?
Well, these days.
Well, that's true. That's true. They could.
But no, yeah, it's usually, I'm not sure which character you're talking about, but.
I can't remember.
Yeah, me either. While I do very much on purpose put in the Black experience in there, I don't want that to be the overarching theme.
Yeah. And it's not. And that's one of the things that I really enjoy about your novel is there are characters for whom that it's very clearly it's a Black experience, and as a white girl it's very eye-opening to read that, right? And I really like that. And I liked that it's just a story about people.
Yep. They're trying to find their way, find the people who will care for them, that they can feel, be themselves with, and, you know, find purpose and love, really. Ultimately, if you break it all down, that's all any of the main characters are trying to do. Find purpose and find love.
Yeah. Well, it sure gripped me. turned into a real page turner. It was a little dangerous to read it when I was going to sleep.
I'm a lover of suspense novels.
Well, that definitely comes across. It was, yeah, I didn't really know what to expect, except that I had read Regret and Triptych. But Regret and Triptych does not give a full picture of the world of what the world of, I don't know, what's going to happen in Gospel of Wolves. It doesn't, there was a lot of things that were very surprising. I'll just put it that way. Yeah, in a good way.
That was actually that was one of the difficult parts, because there's this thing. I forget. I think part of it is, the name escapes me right now. But anyhow, the idea is artists, you have to publish. So when I created Regret and Triptych, it was the first story done, so I released it. Well, that takes place way in the future from Gospel of Wolves. And so when I decided to make this about some of the characters that were going to be in Gospel of Wolves, I had to be very careful in the backstory to hint at things that explains what's going on in Regret and Triptych without spoiling what you're going to read in Gospel of Wolves. So I was really, I was on a tightrope with what information to deliver on that.
No wonder you don't sleep. I mean, I have the same experience of when I'm really involved in something, I have a tendency toward insomnia anyway, but particularly if I'm in some kind of creative deep dive, because my brain is just going, and it's very hard to shut it off.
Yes.
And knowing like the layers and the complexity of what you're dealing with this world and wanting to share information without spoiling other pieces and all of that, like, no wonder. Well, Chris, it's just been amazing getting a chance to chat with you a little bit more and get a picture into your very full color creative life that you're living. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for asking. I admire the work that you do. Well, as you can tell from being, you know, Regret and Trip that came out a few years ago, and you were in the special thanks way back then. But I've really, really appreciated and admired that the work you've been doing, not just with your own creativity and, you know, practicing the different things you preach, but reaching out to other artists and helping them fulfill what they're trying to express. So, you know, being one of them, it's really cool to get a chance to kind of have this, well, to have this conversation.
Wow. Thank you. That means a lot to me. Thanks a lot. That's it. That's a wrap. Thank you so much for joining me today for my conversation with Chris. If you are getting value out of Live Creative Now, the best way to thank me is to tell your friends. Tell them about the podcast, send them to livecreativenow.com or have them find it, look it up on iTunes. I am actually publishing this. It's pre-scheduled by the magic of automation, because if you're listening the day that it goes live on June 22nd, I am actually at music camp up in the mountains, the Santa Cruz Mountains in California, completely disconnected and unplugged from all things internet. There's no cell reception. There's no internet. There's nothing. So I am immersing myself as you listen in one of my creative passions, in my music. And this is something that I have discovered is so incredibly important. We can't immerse ourselves all the time because, you know, we have lives to live. And that's why I talk about the importance of tiny and daily. Finding those nooks and crannies of time, creating those nooks and crannies of time in order to do your creative pursuits in your day-to-day life. And when you get the opportunity, when you can create the opportunity to create big chunks of time for your creative joy, make that happen. I personally make it a priority to set aside at least 3 really big chunks of time every year to fully immerse myself in my creative pursuits, distraction-free, like Jazz Camp West. And in August, another one of those big chunks of time is coming up. It's my Create and Incubate retreat, which I started hosting because I know how important it is to have creative immersion. And my creative immersion retreat experiences have been just so pivotal in my life. So I knew, always knew I wanted to host my own. It's very intimate. It's a small retreat. It's, you know, there's not a huge number of people. You get to sit at the same dinner table as me. And it's in a lovely setting in the beautiful hills above Silicon Valley in Los Gatos, California. And it's happening from August 17th through 21st, 5 days and four nights, where you get uninterrupted create time. You don't have to worry about laundry, cooking, emails, phone calls, errands, driving the kids to soccer, any of that stuff. You really get to just focus and relax. And it's amazing at the end of the retreat when people leave, it's like their shoulders have lowered like 3 inches away from their ears. Everyone's so relaxed and happy. It's such an incredible experience. 5 days of uninterrupted create time to work on any project you want, painting, drawing, collage, work on your novel or memoir, photography. There's a mosaic artist who's going to be there this year. She's come every year, actually. You could even use that time to write the ebook that you've been meaning to write, or design the course that you've been wanting to teach, or plan out your business strategy if that's how you want to use the time. Totally up to you. I lead creative catalyzing sessions every morning to get everybody laughing and out of our heads and into our bodies, because our heads are where the gremlins are. And when we can get into our bodies and out of our heads, that's when we can be our most creative. So we have a special room that we call the incubator for the duration of the retreat, where everybody has dedicated workspace at a table just for you. And the room is set on silent, so you don't have to worry about being tempted away by the juicy conversations that you want to have with all the amazing people who are there. You can really focus on creating. It's amazing. And when you're in the room creating with everybody else, it just creates this special buzz of energy that I've never found anywhere else, except for in a room with a group of other creators where everybody is immersed in their own creativity. It's so incredibly energizing and special. So if you would like to recharge your commitment to your creative spirit and fill your tank with a reserve of energy to propel you through the year, and you'd like to do it in a cozy, beautiful setting with support and guidance and just the right amount of structure from someone you trust, aka yours truly, I would love for you to join me. Just go to createandincubateretreat.com. That's createandincubateretreat.com. I would love to have you. Hope to see you there. And if you have any questions, hop on over to livecreativenow.com, find the contact page, and shoot me an email, and I will be happy, more than happy, to answer. That's it. Until next time, thanks again for joining me, and go get creating.
Live creative now.
Subscribe at livecreativenow.com.